On Radio 4 FM, now we conclude our Book of the Week, The Shivago Affair by Peter Finn and Petra Kuve. It's 1958 and the CIA has been smuggling copies of Boris Pasternak's novel Dr. Shivago into the Soviet Union. When the author is awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature, the Soviet authorities force him to decline. He's also been expelled from the Writers' Union and attacked by the Soviet media. The reader is Nigel Anthony.
The pillorying of Pasternak was front-page news around the world. In the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the cartoonist Bill Mauldin created a Pulitzer Prize-winning image of Pasternak as a ragged gulag prisoner wearing a ball and chain. The caption read, "I won the Nobel Prize for Literature. What was your crime?" Bewilderment at the treatment of Pasternak only increased when three Soviet scientists won the Nobel Prize for Physics. The award was celebrated in Moscow as a national achievement. Pravda explained that while the award in science illustrated the recognition by the Swedish Academy of Sciences of the major merits of Russian and Soviet scientists, the award of the prize for literature was prompted entirely for political motives. A group of prominent writers, including T.S. Eliot, Stephen Spender, Somerset Maugham, E.M. Forster, Graham Greene, and Aldous Huxley, sent a telegram to the Union of Soviet Writers to protest. "We are profoundly anxious about the state of one of the world's great poets and writers, Boris Pasternak. We consider his novel, Dr. Zhivago, a moving personal testimony and not a political document. We appeal to you in the name of the great Russian literary tradition for which you stand, not to dishonour it by victimising a writer revered throughout the whole civilised world." Ernest Hemingway said he would give Pasternak a house if he was expelled from the Soviet Union.
"For a genius such as Pasternak, separation from his country would be a tragedy. But if he comes to us, we shall not disappoint him."
The controversy reinvigorated sales of the novel across Europe and in the United States. It finally hit the top of the New York Times bestseller list, dislodging Nabokov's Lolita. Senior officials in the CIA relished what they saw as a propaganda coup for the West that was entirely manufactured in Moscow. But the CIA concluded that it should not overplay its hand. Pasternak's plight was another reminder of the West's inability to affect events inside the Soviet Union. The international backlash was unwelcome, and the Kremlin wanted a way out of the crisis. President Khrushchev ordered a halt. "Enough. He's admitted his mistakes. Stop it." The terms were left to the bureaucracy. Pasternak was ordered to Moscow, to the Central Committee. In a meeting with Dmitry Polikarpov, the head of the Central Committee's culture department, Pasternak and his lover and literary agent, Olga Ivinskaya, were told that Pasternak would have to make peace with the Soviet people. On November the 4th, Polikarpov phoned Ivinskaya's apartment. "We must ask him to write an open letter to the people," he informed her. Pasternak immediately began to craft an attempt. The letter, addressed to the editors of Pravda, was published on November the 6th. Pasternak said he voluntarily rejected the Nobel Prize when he saw the scope of the political campaign around my novel and realised that this award was a political step which had now led to monstrous consequences. The letter concluded, "I believe that I shall find the strength to restore my good name and the confidence of my comrades." Pasternak's exhaustion and his concern for Ivinskaya combined to give the authorities the concession they wanted. The repeated assertion that he was acting voluntarily stretched the credulity of even Pravda readers. And the fact that he signed any letter of contrition disappointed some Russians. In Ryazan, a schoolteacher named Alexander Solzhenitsyn writhed with shame for him that he would demean himself by pleading with the government. The authorities agreed to restore his and Ivinskaya's ability to earn a living through translation work. But that winter, Pasternak was unable to earn any money, no new translation work was commissioned. On paper, Pasternak was a wealthy man. Feltrinelli had been depositing payments from publishers around the world into a Swiss bank account. But Pasternak realized that if he sought permission to transfer it to Moscow, he would face the perpetual accusation of treacherously living off foreign capital. Pasternak asked the authorities if he could get permission to receive money held by his Norwegian publishers, and he offered to donate part of the royalties to a fund for writers in need. The authorities, unmoved, warned him not to accept any money held in Western banks and forced him to sign a letter renouncing the funds. In the weeks after the Pravda letter, the public hysteria of late October and early November began to fade. Pasternak was worn out. Yet in a letter to Feltrinelli, he displayed some of his old heightened vigour, describing his life as distressing, deadly dangerous, but full of significance and responsibility, dizzyingly enthralling, and worthy of being accepted and lived in glad and grateful obedience to God. The Nobel Award ceremony took place on December the 10th, 1958, at Stockholm Concert Hall, which was packed with 2,000 dignitaries. Towards the end of the ceremony, it was simply noted of Pasternak that the laureate has, as is known, announced that he does not wish to accept the prize. This renunciation in no way changes the validity of the distinction. It remains only for the Swedish Academy to state, with regret, that it was not possible for the acceptance to take place. The audience listened in complete silence. In the West, there was no longer any doubt that Pasternak's renunciation of the Nobel Prize and the letter of apology to Pravda were coerced. The Soviet authorities reacted with predictable fury. Polikarpov told Ivinskaya that Pasternak was to cut off all contact with the foreign press. He now put up signs in English, French and German on his front and side doors in Perodyalkino. They stated, "Pasternak does not receive. He is forbidden to receive foreigners." The CIA's efforts to exploit Dr. Zhivago were re-energized by the Nobel crisis. The CIA memo concluded, "An all-out overt exploitation of Dr. Zhivago would not harm Pasternak more than he has already harmed himself." Shortly afterwards, the Soviet-Russia division of the CIA said it was forwarding by sea freight a batch of copies so that American travellers in Europe could carry it into the Soviet Union. The CIA also provided elaborate guidelines for its agents to encourage tourists to talk about literature and Dr. Zhivago with Soviet citizens they might meet. "We feel that Dr. Zhivago is an excellent springboard for conversations with Soviets on the general theme of communism versus freedom of expression," the head of the Soviet-Russia division, John Morey, wrote in a memo in April 1959. As early as August 1958, even before the publication of the first Russian-language edition of Dr. Zhivago, the CIA began to consider a miniature paperback edition to be printed on lightweight paper. Such an edition had the obvious benefit of being easily concealed and infiltrated. By July 1959, at least 9,000 copies of a miniature edition of Dr. Zhivago had been printed. CIA records state that the miniature books were passed out by agents who had contact with Soviet tourists and officials in the West. 2,000 copies of this edition were set aside for dissemination to Soviet and East European students at the 1959 World Festival of Youth and Students for Peace and Friendship in Vienna. The Kremlin spent millions of dollars on these events, and the Vienna Festival was supervised personally by Alexander Shelyapin, the head of the KGB. The CIA created the Independent Service for Information, ISI, to recruit American students to disrupt the festival. The ISI was headed by Gloria Steinem, a recent graduate. When the CIA's involvement was revealed in 1967, Steinem said she found the CIA officers with whom she worked liberal and far-sighted, and open to an exchange of ideas. The ISI set up a news bureau to feed information to Western correspondents who were refused entry to the festival, and they smuggled copies of an unsanctioned newspaper into event venues. Newspapers published in several languages were brought in at night and placed in the toilets. Hotel porters were paid to slip newspapers under the doors of senior officials attending the festival. The aim was to expose delegates from the Soviet orbit to revisionist writing. The Soviet delegation of students and performers arrived in a sweltering Vienna on 40 buses. Among them was the young ballet dancer, Rudolf Nureyev. Crowds of Russian émigrés swarmed the Soviet convoy when it entered the city and tossed copies of the CIA miniature edition of Dr. Zhivago through the open windows of the buses. Pasternak's novel was the book most in demand among many of the delegations, and copies of it were handed out in bags from Vienna department stores, in the darkness of movie theatres, and at a changing roster of pickup points, the locations of which were circulated by word of mouth. For the trip home, delegates tucked books inside camping equipment, stage sets, film cans, and other hiding places. Some of the official hostility in Moscow began to ease after that summer. Later in the year, the Union of Soviet Writers suggested that Pasternak could apply to be reinstated, but he rejected the approach. Pasternak began to venture out again in public in Moscow in 1959, and his first appearance, to attend a concert of the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Leonard Bernstein, drew the notice of the press. This was the first major concert tour by an American organization after the signing in 1958 of the United States-Soviet Union Cultural Exchange Agreement. Bernstein was a sensation, bringing audiences to their feet. While in Leningrad, Bernstein invited Pasternak to the final Moscow concert on September the 11th. Moscow Conservatory's Great Hall was packed with the intelligentsia. Pasternak attended with his wife, and every eye in the hall seemed to focus on the two people. There was a subdued buzzing as people motioned to one another and stared. The New York Times reported, "The tension, almost unbearable in its intensity, was broken suddenly when Mr. Bernstein appeared on stage, followed by a tremendous cheer. Some of those present, perhaps including Mr. Bernstein, were sure that at least part of the enthusiastic greeting was meant to be shared by Mr. Pasternak." Pasternak visited Bernstein backstage, and the two men shared a bear hug. "You have taken us up to heaven," said Pasternak. "Now, we must return to earth." Boris Pasternak died in May 1960. Soon afterwards, Olga Ivinskaya was imprisoned by the Soviet authorities for her part in the publication abroad of Dr. Zhivago. In 1964, the novel was made into a film which was banned in Russia. Eventually, in 1988, after the fall of the Soviet Union, Dr. Zhivago was serialized in the pages of Novy Mir, and the following year, Yevgeny Pasternak was permitted to travel to Stockholm to collect his father's Nobel Medal.
The Zhivago Affair by Peter Finn and Petra Kuve was read by Nigel Anthony, abridged by Libby Spurrier and produced by Joanna Green. It was a peer production for BBC Radio 4. Following recent crises of leadership in some of Britain's largest institutions, Sir John Tusser explains the gap between the leaders and those they lead to reveal the state of leadership in Britain today.
After bruising encounters with the leaders of mega corporations such as Google, Starbucks and Amazon, Margaret Hodge says she spotted a troubling tendency.
Tax is not a matter of choice. Tax is a matter of following the laws that are there.
You get the feeling there that leadership lives in a sort of elite bubble and doesn't really understand the society or the economy or the customer base in which it operates.
The leadership gap is at 11 o'clock this morning.